Joining us today on Perspectives is New York Times bestselling author James Grippando. He is the author of the recent novel Cash Landing. And this is based actually on a true event that happened in the Miami area. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. But first, we'd like to welcome James to our show. And as I mentioned, he is the author of the novel Cash Landing. This is his 23rd novel, and he was a trial lawyer for 12 years. He also has worked with lawyers right after he got out of school. But he has a very interesting, growing up period, and it's like a neat little story, and we'll talk about that as well. But James, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
As I mentioned, your background growing up, it was very interesting. And I like, for our generation, I guess, the fact that you could do all those things instead of just sitting in front of a television or a computer playing games. You guys had, a football field, a baseball field, swimming, ice skating. So tell us a little bit about that.
It's fun. I grew up in a rural area in northern Illinois. And I actually went back to my high school for the first time in almost 35 years this past April to share with the students at Antioch Community High School my own experiences of growing up there and how it's sort of shaped my writing, that freedom of, having a dog who never spent a day in his life on a leash and, living on a lake where there was hunting and fishing and ice fishing in the wintertime and so forth. All of those things, I think, shape you as a writer and really give you an insight into nature and all of those things that, nowadays we take it for, we would never think of kind of like telling our kids to, see you in the morning and be home before dark. It was just, and I have three children now myself, and they grow up so differently from me, and I really long for sort of those more innocent might be not the right word, but certainly there was a lot more freedom. I think that background really gave me the courage to branch out and follow my dreams. I was a lawyer, the largest law firm in Miami, and I just decided one day that I was going to give that up because I had always had this dream. Never a goal to be a writer. I was too practical, I think, to ever think that I could actually make a living being a writer. When the time came to make that decision, and, some of your listeners may remember, the late 80s, the top television show drama on was called L.A. Law, a pretty interesting show about lawyers, really one of the first really, really good television dramas. And then, the hottest book in the country was Scott Turow's Presumed Innocent. And either arrogantly or naively, I decided I can do that. And I really think that it was that independent spirit of the way I grew up that allowed me to do that. Some people questioned my timing, however. I mean, I left the firm after I was newly married, and my wife and I had our first child in July of 96, and September of 96 is when I gave my notice to the law firm saying I'm going to try to be a writer. And people thought I had flipped my lid. In fact, my mother still breaks my life into two chapters, and that's when Jimmy had a job and when he went off and did this writer thing. But, 23 novels later, with Cash Landing just out this summer, things worked out okay, I guess.
We're visiting with James Grippando. He is New York Times bestselling author. The recent novel is Cash Landing. You mentioned your mother there, and also in reading your background, you mentioned that living where you did and having those experiences really helped you as a writer later, but you mentioned also your mother was a big inspiration when you were growing up. Did she read to you, or did she write as well? I know she was a nurse, but what else?
Yeah, my mother was she has a very interesting life herself. She wanted to be a doctor, and my mother, she's still alive. My mother's 87 years old now. And she's really smart. She makes me look stupid. And I think my children, that skips a generation, So my children are really smart anyway. So they got that from my mother. But she wanted to be a medical doctor. And in college, she flunked chemistry. But she knew she hadn't flunked. And she went to the teacher and the teacher literally, this is back in the day, in the 30s, and basically he told her, you know, over my dead body, are you going to take a man's spot in medical school? And, you know, it's, that's really not that long ago. We have women alive today who have dealt with that kind of attitude. So she went on and became a nurse. But not undeterred by her chemistry professor's views, she went on and she became one of the first nurses in the country to get a doctorate degree. It was not a medical doctorate degree, but it was a doctorate in education. So she went on to teach nursing. Actually, she was a grammar school teacher while she was getting her doctorate degree. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and she was a nurse, you know, working the night shifts and getting her doctorate degree. And she went on to write one of the most successful entry-level nursing textbooks in the country called Nursing Perspectives and Issues. And she gave me my first publication byline, because by then I was a lawyer when the book was doing quite well. They did like the third or fourth edition, and I wrote the chapter on nurses' legal rights and responsibilities. So how many people get a chance to collaborate with their mother on a book? And that was just great. And, of course, you know, as I said, I tease her about the fact that she breaks my life into the two chapters, but she's very proud of me and still goes to all of my book signings, and, you know, it's been a wonderful ride. And her book is still in print, you know, so it's pretty amazing.
Two other people that you mention in your, I guess, your growing up background, the fact that one of your teachers in school, he was very influential, and also one of the first judges that you work with when you got a job after law school.
Right. Yeah, you know, I James Corrigan was my high school English professor, and you know, a lot of people were sort of just terrified of him because he had this reputation of, well, I can tell you exactly, this is the best illustration of the my first paper I wrote for James Corrigan was a C-.
Wow.
And that was the highest grade in the class, so he was that kind of a teacher. But by the end of the year, he had this look about him. He almost looked like Ernest Hemingway. You know, he had this salt and pepper beard and the sort of the rugged outdoorsman look to him. But he was just a wonderful teacher and taught me that I wouldn't say that he taught me to be a writer, but he ultimately gave me the confidence that, you know, I've got some talent, and maybe people would someday want to actually read what I've written. You know, and that's a huge boost you can give to a high school student, you know, with all the insecurities you're dealing with, is that you have a voice and it's in there and you've got to find it, and other people might actually want to hear it. And that's really, you know, that's what I took away from that year, my senior year English with James Corrigan. It was great when I went back to the high school this past April, and they had actually... We walked the halls, and they have named the halls in the high school now, which I think is a great idea. I think other high schools should catch on to this. And they've named the halls after these legendary teachers like that. And so I got to stroll down Corrigan Way as
wow.
I went back to that. It was just really terrific. It was a nice tribute, and what a wonderful teacher he was. The other influence you mentioned was Judge Clark. Judge Clark was just a Southern gentleman to the hilt, and I worked for him when I was right out of law school. It was he's on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court right below the United States Supreme Court. So it was a very sought-after job to work for a federal judge of his stature right out of law school. And I was lucky in that he had a real relationship with his clerks. You know, sometimes not all judges interact with their clerks or take on that mentor role that Judge Clark did, and he would invite us whenever there were judges in from out of town. The clerks, he would make sure that the clerks had lunch with them, and they were just, you know, terrific jurists like Frank Johnson, who's a legend in the the civil rights movement and the decisions that he made, with crosses burning on his front yard and so forth. Nonetheless, had the courage to make the decisions he made, and all of those sort of experiences sort of found their way into, I think, in my writing over the years. And most obvious was my first novel, was a book called The Pardon. And while I was working for Judge Clark, back then the Georgia and Florida were executing more death row inmates than the 48 other states combined, including Texas. So, I mean, they were really on the forefront there. So I got, and the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals was sort of like the court of last resort for many of these appeals. So it was, you know, it was one of those things where I always went, left the office late at night, you know, and these last-minute appeals, there'd be an execution scheduled for 7 in the morning. Boxes would land in the office about 6 o'clock the prior evening. And we'd have all this time, you know, hardly any time to sift through this stuff. And I always left there thinking, wow, I'm glad this is Judge Clark's decision and not my decision, because you want to make the right decision in these kind of circumstances. And so that sort of shaped, I took that experience of the death penalty work, wrote a novel called The Pardon 3 or 4 years later, and about a death row inmate hours away from execution for a murder he may not have committed. And I would defy anybody to read that novel and figure out where I stand on the death penalty, because I don't write preachy novels. I write entertaining novels. But that certainly my experience with Judge Clark and wondering, what if the guy didn't do it, and that's just was a great question to explore for my first novel, and the experience with Judge Clark gave it a real sense of reality and urgency that I would never have had without that experience.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author James Gripando. James is the author of the recent novel Cash Landing, and he's been discussing also his first book, The Pardon, and other influences that he's had in his life growing up, including his mother, this judge, Mr. Corrigan, his teacher in high school. And one of the things that Mr. Corrigan stressed for you, a lot of people in this day and age, some people say, people don't read books anymore. They wait for the movie or whatever. But you were given the advice by Mr. Corrigan that reading was so important if you wanted to be a writer.
Yeah, I to this day, I have, I work with children a lot, and I think Corrigan had that influence on me, was that, to give back to young people and develop new talent. And I'm so amazed that, and I'll get in a conversation with a high school student or middle school student, and they say they want to be a writer, and I'll try to give them a few tips, and then I'll say, okay, well now, mandatory reading for school aside, what are you reading now? And so often the answer is, really nothing, that really was the importance, that was stressed by James Corrigan to me, was that, rule number one, if you're going to be you got to be a writer, you got to be a reader, I think that's a message that is needs to be conveyed now more than ever, because, I'll do, for example, I'll go to a middle school someplace, and I'll say, I wrote a middle school novel called Leap Holes about a magical old lawyer who travels back in time and does his legal research by meeting famous Dred Scott or Rosa Parks or some person, famous people from actual legal cases. So middle schools have used it in their social studies program and so forth. And it's been a great experience. But one thing that's, I won't say disconcerting, but it was certainly eye-opening, is, I would ask children to raise their hand and say, okay, now if you're reading a novel, how many people here will, read 10 pages before you give up on a novel? And there are a few hands go up, and it's like, how many people will read, 20 pages? And there might be one hand up in the cage. How many will read 30 pages? And there's nobody, who will give a novel 30 pages. In fact, I would say the average is about a page, if you haven't caught their attention. And that's the world we live in now. It's that, that sort of instant gratification requirement. And that was, something I didn't really figure on when I took my first stab at writing for young adults, is that, you had better have an amazing hook. It does apply. I write suspense, so yes, I do have to have that sort of immediate hook, but man, for the younger generation, it's even more of a requirement of an immediate hook.
So it would be harder to write for young adults?
It was, I thought I would bang that out in my spare time in about 6 months. It took me 3 years to write Leap Holes.
Wow.
So it's really it's a challenge, because kids see through it. The other thing is that, children, I think, are a little more savvy, maybe than I was growing up, especially where I grew up. It was sort of you know, I don't really didn't really see the things that they see on the news and in or on the internet or on YouTube or that sort of thing. So they see through. Well, if you come across as not cool, they pick it up really quickly.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author James Grappando. James is the author of the recent novel Cash Landing. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, this is based on a true event. And we're going to ask James to kind of guide us through that. Because, James, I don't recall exactly how this happened when I read some of the other materials that they send me. But you had presented something to a judge. I'm not sure if it was Judge Clark or not, but then he said, you ought to write a book about this.
Yeah, you know, actually, he came to me. It was not Judge Clark. Clark has spent Judge Clark has passed away several years now, but it was a friend of mine who is a federal district judge in Miami, and he'd practiced law in Miami since the 60s, and had seen an awful lot in terms of interesting cases, bizarre cases you can only imagine. You know, I mean, the stuff that has come through the court system in a place like Miami since the 80s. And he said, you know, and I all the time I have people coming up to me saying, I've got this great idea for a book and all you've got to do is write it. So I'm like, I know right away they don't know anything about writing. You know, writing is not about the ideas. It's generally about this discipline of sitting down and doing it. But in this case, I'm like, you know, it's a federal judge. He's a friend. I'm like, okay, you know, you've got an interesting case. I'd like to hear about it. And so he says, well, first of all, you know about the money flights, right? And I'm already intrigued because I don't know anything about the money flights, but the money flights sounds pretty interesting to me. He says, yeah, there's, you know, every Sunday afternoon, there's a Lufthansa flight from Frankfurt that lands, 747, that lands at Miami International Airport. And in the cargo belly of the plane is anywhere from $80 to $100 million in cash, $50 and $100 bills, because the German banks don't have any need for all these American bills, and Miami's a very cash-driven economy, so they deliver them to Miami, and the Federal Reserve Bank is about 4 miles away from the airport, so they load these bricks of bills into a Brink security truck, take it through customs at a warehouse, and then once it clears customs, it's delivered to the Federal Reserve branch in Miami. I said, well, that's pretty interesting. He says, yeah, well, you know, well, there were these five guys from Miami who really weren't very sophisticated crooks who ended up in a courtroom before this judge. That's how he knew about the case. But he says the actual heist itself is one of the biggest airport heists ever. And in fact, it rivals the famous heist in New York in 1978 that became the premise for Martin Scorsese's movie Goodfellas, which, you know, is about an airport heist of cash. And he says, yeah, this one is like they got it. So these guys come up with a plan, he says. And so they show up at Miami International Airport, and they've got an insider, of course. All of these cases always involve an insider. And this is all true. This is not the part that's made up in Cash Landing. This part of the story is actually true. What happened, there was one of the security guards for the armored car service went to his friends and said, this is too easy, okay? Look, you know, first of all, you know, the money has to be laid out on the floor of a warehouse in order to clear customs. Because the security guards don't work for the customs service, they have to remove their weapons. So there's nobody's armed watching this money that's laid out on the floor. And the security cameras don't work, if you can believe that. And this is the kind of thing I couldn't write into a novel because people would never believe it. But this is true. So it does, and he says, and then best of all, is that the back doors to the warehouse lead to a perimeter road around the airport, so you don't even have to go through the security checkpoint. You just drive out the back of the warehouse, and you're a minute and a half from the expressway, and you're gone. So he talks four of his friends into helping him do this. So the five of them plan this event, and when he gives the signal, the four guys drive up in a pickup truck. They've got one gun among them. They're they're really amateurs. And they put bandanas over their face, and they run into the warehouse. And this is where it almost gets sort of, Elmore Leonard-ish kind of comical, is that what these guys don't realize is money is heavy. The money is stuffed into $2 million per bag, which weighs about 40 pounds. So these guys are trying to grab as much loot as they possibly can, and literally money is spilling out of the bags onto the floor as they're pitching it into the back of the pickup truck. But they get away, and they dropped one bag on the way, and that they get away with about $7.8 million or something like that was reported. So, and then, things are looking pretty good. They're all slapping high fives back at the ringleader's house, and they divide up the money, and they decide, well, we're going to bury the money until things cool down. But one of the, as I say, these guys are amateurs, and, of course, one of them has a huge cocaine addiction. The brother-in-law, he's about 400 pounds. Again, I'm not making this up. This is the true part of the story. This isn't the fictional Cash Landing version. He's about 400 pounds and 5'5" tall, morbidly obese, cocaine addict, who also has even bigger weakness is strippers. So he starts buying $40,000 Rolex watches for the strippers down at the Gold Dust, strip joint or whatever it is. And two things happen then, which really turn, and this is where Cash Landing sort of picks up because things then get very interesting. Not only does the FBI start to figure out, hey, maybe there's some connection here. All of a sudden, this loser has no money. There's $7 million missing from, the airport, and now he's buying $40,000 Rolexes for any girl who will sit on his lap. But more dangerous than the FBI getting suspicious is that really, really bad criminals start to figure out that these goofballs have a lot of money, and they kidnap the brother-in-law who's down at the strip joint buying the Rolexes and demand $1 million ransom from the ringleader of the group, and that's when things really get hairy. And that's sort of where Cash Landing takes up.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author James Grappando, and he is talking about his latest novel, Cash Landing, which is actually based on something that happened. It's real. Of course, James has taken the different characters and inserted them, but we've heard of organized crime, and this novel basically touches on disorganized crime because these guys, James, they remind me when I first started reading this book, right away, like some of the characters that we used to watch on TV, like Laurel and Hardy or the Three Stooges, because there's always a smart guy, and then there are the other two that are just kind of like, okay, whatever you say. And again, it just was so easy the way it happened, and the fact that, 40 pounds is 40 pounds, and you just can't, load up like four bags around your arms and take them in. But I think, you take the reader on a very interesting roller coaster ride from the very beginning. I mean, they're listening to the Miami Dolphins on the radio and having a good time. And well, we don't want to give away the ending, but it's very interesting. And this is something, again, that you involve a little bit of some of your characters, right, from other books?
Yeah, this is, I write a series, and about half of my novels are in the series. So the lead character of this series is Jack Switek, and he's in about 12 of the 23 novels so far. Cash Landing, I never try to shoehorn my serial character into a novel where there's really no role for him. But Jack is married to an FBI agent whose name is Andy Henning, and she's been in several of the Jack Switek novels. Obviously, now they're married and so forth and about to start a family. And I thought, well, this would be a really interesting book to put in Andy as sort of almost her own standalone, because I needed an interesting FBI character about this. And I actually considered writing Cash Landing as a true crime book, because it had that many components working for it. Ultimately, I decided to do what I do best, and that is to write it as a work of fiction. And mainly the reason is because I wanted to get into the heads of the characters a way that I couldn't get into if I wrote it as nonfiction. you know, most of the guys involved in this now are in jail. I'm not giving anything away by saying that. I mean, it is really, you know, of course, things are going to start to go really wrong when, you know, you've got guys this incompetent being chased by some really scary criminals and the FBI. So it's a little bit like watching a train wreck. And the FBI character, Andy Henning, I think lends a certain level-headedness to the whole storyline that otherwise might be bizarre and out of control.
We're visiting with James Grippando, New York Times bestselling author. His latest novel is Cash Landing. We have a couple minutes probably left here in the interview, James, but I want you to tell us a little bit about your co-writer. Very interesting.
Yeah. you mean Sam.
Yes.
My golden retriever, yeah. You know, I've had two golden retrievers now during my course as a writer, and now it's Max. Max is a golden. And it's an interesting story how I got Max is because I had written when Sam passed away. He got very sick very fast and passed away at age 9, which is even for a large dog, that's pretty young. And I wrote a story about my co-writer, Sam, and it ran in the Miami Herald, and it got syndicated. And probably I've gotten more articles about this story about Max or Sam and the author than anything I've ever written. And a woman up in Maine read the story and told me, well, if you ever, you know, she was weeping when she called me. It was such a sad story to her. So she raised puppies and lived on 50 acres up in Maine and said, if you ever need another co-writer, you be sure to let me know. So about a year and a half later, I called her and said, you know, I think I'm going to take you up on this. And it was September, and I said, I'd really love to have a puppy for Christmas. And she was so sad and apologetic and said, you know what, I just had a litter of 9 puppies, and they're all spoken for. I don't have any. So she calls me back about a day later, and she's crying again. She says, I just reread that story you wrote about Sam, and I can't say no, so please take the golden that I was going to keep for myself. So we got the pick of the litter with Max, and so now Max is my new co-writer, which I think Sam would be very happy about.
Well, James, thank you very much for sharing that story and other stories about, you know, you growing up and your career as a lawyer and as a writer. And I want to let people know that the name of the book, again, is Cash Landing, and you can find it on various, you know, bookstores on the Internet. And James also has his own page. So if you go to, is it jamesgrippando.com?
That's it.
James, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.